Okay, anyone have any questions before we start? Let me begin by kind of reiterating what we're trying to do in this class. We're trying to get some insight into this fundamental question of war and peace, what makes for war, for a stable international system. And we're doing that by looking at what major international relations theorists have had to say, and using their ideas, their arguments, as kind of a foil, as a, you know, we react to them as a way of bringing these issues into focus and getting insight from the review of the historical evidence. You know, it's a technique that we use to draw meaning from the historical evidence. Because it's very easy to do history is just, you know, just a story of this happened and that happened and that happened. But if you want to draw meaning from that story, you have to bring a sort of conceptual framework to bear. And in fact, there is this very powerful set of ideas associated, especially with realist theorists like Kenneth Waltz. And you saw the kind of argument that Waltz made in that a piece of his that you read the first week in the class. And it's a powerful argument because it's counterintuitive. It's like, if someone asks you, well, how do you explain a war? Your natural inclination is to try and figure out who was responsible. Which political leaders made which decisions which brought on the war? And the natural assumption is that wars result from aggression. So you want to figure out who the aggressor is, right? So the whole question of what makes for war becomes a whole attempt to figure out who is to blame, right? But these realist theorists say, no, you can't approach it like that. It's not like statecraft is the crucial thing, or policy choices or what are crucial, right? Because these people have only limited freedom of action. They're constrained because they find themselves in a system. It's the system that constrains them. And the system is what plays the fundamental role. You want to understand war, you have to look below the surface of the particular decisions that are being made and try and figure out how this system works. You know, it's like, you look below the surface. See, it's like you want to understand the movement of the tides? You can't study in detail the dynamics of each successive wave, right? You have to approach the problem in a deeper way, right? So that's the basic premise there. And they make this argument that in a system of sovereign states, you know, an anarchic system where there's no overarching authority to say you can do this, but you can't do that, right? States have to provide for their own security. It's a self-help system. And in that kind of system, where everyone is out to provide for their own security, that competition for security, competition for power, puts states on a collision course with each other. That, they claim, is the real cause of war. And Waltz, in that piece that you read, points specifically to the run-up to the First World War. In that kind of system where you have a number of great powers, not just two, in this case you had five, and, you know, no one power is so strong that it could stand up to a coalition of everyone else. Right? And power is distributed not totally evenly, but no one is a hegemon. In that kind of system, these states are led to kind of form these alliances. But when you form these alliances, you become dependent on your alliance partners. And when you become dependent on your alliance partners, they can drag you into a war. Because in this kind of system, you're led to form these really rigid alliances. You have no choice. You can't exercise your independent judgment. And he says, If Austria marched, Germany had to follow, you know, right or wrong. Whether Austria was right or wrong, Germany could be dragged into the war by her weaker allies. Same thing on the Entente side. France marched, Russia had to follow. Russia couldn't accept a situation where France was defeated and Russia would have to face Germany just all by herself. You have no choice, right? So this is a deeply unstable situation, according to Waltz. Right? It doesn't take much to light the powder keg. That's a common view. I remember hearing that kind of argument when I was an undergraduate in the early 1960s. And if it were true, that would be powerful evidence in support of this kind of structural interpretation of the origins of the First World War in particular, but of war in general. But we want to see whether it is true. We want to see whether it's the case that power political logic, that realist logic, that the imperatives created by a system where no one else could provide for your security, you have to look after yourself, whether those imperatives lead states to pursue these really dangerous policies, the policies that could lead to wars. Right? And one of the key points, yeah?
So it seems like Walt,
well, one example when it's not the case?
Yeah, so you can point out one example when
Well, he thinks it is the case. That's the way they do it. It's not as though we don't know what the answers are. Let's look at a huge mass of evidence in a totally open-minded way. You know, that's not the way theorizing works in this field or any other field. Right? So the function of his citing that case is simply to make it plausible to the reader that this is not just abstract theorizing, but his arguments connect with the real world. And since most of the normal reader of Waltz isn't going to be like you, isn't going to be kind of a skeptical like that, right? So Waltz will feel perfectly free about making these kind of broad brush arguments, and then they'll say things like if someone like me comes along and says, "Well, this isn't entirely correct," and so on, it's not quite right to say that. Austria dragged Germany into the First World War because Germany's a much stronger country and Austria had to kind of clear everything with Germany and so on. They could dismiss those sorts of counter-arguments as nitpicking. You know, it's like, I paint with a broad brush. Obviously, I don't get every detail right, but my goal is to get at the very heart of things, right? Historians, you can't see the forest for the trees. It's a good question because it's important to understand these things. One of the big issues that you have to work out for yourself is, does this mean that this kind of theorizing is just kind of worthless? It's saying no, and you can see the function that it has in helping us draw out meaning from the story. Because if it is basically wrong, and if in fact it's the opposite kind of dynamic that's at play. In other words, when states tend to think in realist power political terms and then pursue policies that make sense given the structure of the system, you know, if those kind of policies lead to stability and not instability, well, it has very important implications. First of all, the whole question of the origins of war means that states aren't rational, that they don't think in power political terms, that all the problems come from their failure to do so. And then implicit in that is this whole notion of, if you want to figure out what sort of, if there are general principles that should guide foreign policy, then the answer is yes, it's those realist principles. See, the big irony of this whole argument that these realists make, which is that power politics leads to war, realist policies lead to war, and so on, is that if you really believe that, then what advice are you going to offer the political leaders, you know? If you really think that realist policies are bad, on the one hand, because they lead to war, why are you recommending realist policies? And yet they do recommend realist policies. So there's that contradiction there. right? But for our purposes, we're taking all this stuff and we're looking at the story. And we looked at the aftermath of the Bosnian crisis. And what was quite striking there was that there was a detente between Germany and Russia. The Potsdam Agreement of 1910, Sontag talks about this, it's between Tsar and the Kaiser. This symbolizes a certain relaxation of tensions, an improved political relationship between Germany and Russia. And why was this? Because both of those powers understood that hostile relationship was not in the interest of either of them. You never profit in international politics from having enemies, right? The more friends you have, the fewer enemies you have, the better. You know, this whole Bismarck notion in a Europe of five great powers, the key thing is to be one of three, right? Because the fewer friends you have, the more dependent you are on whichever friends are left to you. You don't want to be isolated in the world. You don't want to be, you know, weak if push comes to shove and you get in a war. You don't want to be excessively dependent on your allies. You want freedom of action so that you could chart a course that's in accordance with your interests. When you become dependent on your allies, you're going to have to support them, right or wrong. You don't want that, right? So Russians knew that it was not to their interest to have a very bad relationship with Germany, because that would make Germany dependent on Austria, force Germany to give Austria, you know, more of a free hand than she otherwise would, and it would also make Russia dependent on Britain and France. It made much more sense to preserve a certain degree of freedom of action by having a decent relationship with Russia, so that instead of Russia being dependent on Britain and France, Britain and France would be dependent on Russia. The worse relations were between Germany and the Western powers, the better off Russia would be. Because both Germany and the Western powers would be competing for Russian favor. You know, as long as they hadn't totally written Russia off. You know, there was a chance that they could win Russia over, because relations with Russia weren't as bad as they were with the, in the case of Britain and France with Germany, in the case of Germany with Britain and France. Right? So the whole logic of a system based on power, countries that pursue policies that make sense in power political terms, like Russia in this case, you know, this leads to détente. This leads to good relations. You can see how you can extend the logic of this argument. You know, if it's good to be friends with, you know, two other of the European great powers, then it's better still to be friends with three other great powers, because then you would be less dependent, less worried about the threat of defection on the part of one of your partners. And it would be better still to be friends with all of the other European powers. And if this is a logic that applies to all the states in the system, then everyone has an incentive to be friends with everyone else. And so that should lead to a general tendency towards stability, right? In principle, you know, if you factor out all these substantive considerations about Alsace-Lorraine and the Balkans and so on, and you just look at the working of a pure system based on power politics, it should tend towards stability. And it's not simply on the in the holy area of Russo-German relations that you see this kind of phenomenon coming into play. You see it also, to a certain extent, when you look at relations between Germany and the two Western powers, Britain and France. The first Moroccan crisis, you know, 1905-1906, ended with the Treaty of Algeciras. This was not the end of the story. There was, in fact, a certain détente in relations between France and Germany, symbolized by an agreement worked out, the French foreign minister's name was Pichon, in February 1909 on Morocco. Right? And the whole basic idea is the Germans would go along with French policy of political penetration of Morocco. In exchange for that, the Germans would have certain commercial benefits, the right to trade more freely and engage in economic activity in Morocco. It was striking a deal. And there were a lot of people in France that were unhappy with the situation that of dependence on Russia, of very bad relations with Germany, so that France was increasingly inclined to give Russia free hand. Because when the Franco-Russian alliance was first signed in the 1890s, the French took great care at that point not to give carte blanche to Russia in matters of the Balkans, just as the Russians weren't willing to go to war to help France recover Alsace-Lorraine. There was a certain distance. But the worst relations between France and Germany were, the more dependent France was on Russia, and the more the French had to basically support Russian ambitions in the Balkans, no matter what they were, no matter how destabilizing they were. And in fact, there are a lot of people in France that were unhappy about the drift of Franco-German relations and wanted to improve them, especially in business circles. This point about the business circles is relevant because when you're trying to understand this period, one of the arguments that you have to contend with is this whole argument that the First World War was a clash of imperialisms, that imperialisms are to be understood in economic terms, that it's this fundamental economic conflict lay at the heart of all these political tensions that culminated in the war. Right? And yet when you look at relations between Germany and France or relations between Germany and Britain, you find that it's exactly the opposite that's the case. The business leaders of industry and of finance, these were the people who were most pacifically minded. These are the people who wanted to do most to avoid it. And I should say there's a very impressive study of Franco-German relations in this period by a French historian named Raymond Poitevin. And his basic argument is that in these years before the First World War, there was this growing interpenetration of economic interests between France and Germany. And basically for two reasons. One had to do with heavy industry. Heavy industry, the production of steel, finishing industries based on the production of steel. This was the heart of the industrial economies of the early 20th century. Steel was of fundamental importance in those days. It was also of fundamental importance for military use. And yet you had this situation where there was this natural complementarity between France and Germany in this whole area of heavy industry. Why was this? Because after the development of the Thomas process at the end of the 1870s, the iron ore that you found on the French side of the border in French Lorraine, they called it Minette iron ore, became very good for the production of steel. But to produce steel, you need two things. You need iron ore, and then you need a certain kind of coal, the kind of coal that you could transform into metallurgical coke. Because as you know, steel is produced by a chemical reaction between coal and iron ore. And the coal, the right kind of coal, coking coal, laid on the German side of the border, in the Ruhr, which is a valley just east of the Rhine River, and so as technology improved, it became more. You needed less and less coal in proportion to iron ore to produce a ton of steel. So the center of gravity of the steel industry shifted in Germany to the west, to both to German Lorraine and also to French Lorraine. And so this was where you had the most modern plants, And this is where you had French and German capital kind of working hand in hand in the development of heavy industry. Not just that, the second major complementarity had to do with finance. French were savers. The French population is not growing nearly as fast as that of any of the other major powers in Europe. And so the French economy isn't growing as fast as, say, the German economy. So the French save, and they have this excess capital. German economy is growing by leaps and bounds. They have a hunger for capital. So it makes sense for the French to invest in German industry. So you had a lot of things going on in that area. I should say, you know, that you know, there was this whole big deal of the creation of a unified currency in Europe, the euro. And people thought that this was a matter of just absolutely fundamental political importance. It was a great symbol of European unification, a single European currency. And what people forget is that there was a single currency in Europe before 1914. It was called gold. You know, every single national currency, the French franc, the German mark, the British pound, this was simply a name for a certain amount of gold, a certain number of grams of gold. And the fact that you had a common currency in effect, that you had very low tariffs, that you didn't even need passports in those days to go from one country to another. This was a period when the economies of the industrialized countries, the countries that, in Western Europe, basically, Germany, Britain, France, the Low Countries and so on, were being knit together in a globalized economy, right? Or a Europeanized economy, at least. And so these people, these people who kind of were the most important figures in French business, French industry, French finance, were an important force for moderate foreign policy. Same point about Anglo-German relations. These businessmen, people involved in banking and trade and so on, they were a powerful lobby for détente in Anglo-German relations. And there's a political argument, a powerful political argument for détente. You don't profit from bad relations. You profit from good relations. And so it's not as though those forces were totally incapable of affecting the course of events. And it's quite striking that just as after the Bosnian crisis there was the détente in Russo-German relations, so after the first Moroccan crisis there was a certain détente in Anglo-German relations. As I say, in the case of France and Germany, this was symbolized by that February 1909 agreement. But it didn't last. Okay? That's why what I'm going to be talking about today, this the crises from 1911, 1912, 1913 are so important. 1911, second Moroccan crisis, very different from the first Moroccan crisis. Why is it different? Because the first Moroccan crisis led to a détente. This one didn't. This one was a setting of the fuse. I mean, if you look at the very first paragraph of the chapter in Sontag that deals with this whole business. The chapter is called From Agadir to Armageddon. You could see the logic spelled out there. What's the logic? Basically, the French come out of this crisis able to kind of take over practically all of Morocco, except for that little strip that was given to Spain on the north.